This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello, and welcome to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. It's the best interviews, guests, headlines, and music from the past week's Media Morning shows. We're also broadcasting now on Rabble Podcasting Network at rabble.ca. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. On this week's show, we are going to feature an interview with Jahanzeb Hussain, our Media Mornings correspondent. He is in Pakistan, in Karachi, talking about the legacy of the recent elections, as well as U.S. drone strikes. We'll also speak with Megan Rode of Human Rights Watch in New York City, as well as Bridget Tully with Families of Sisters in Spirit in Ottawa, about the recent RCMP investigation announcement into the abuses of Aboriginal women in British Columbia. And we'll also speak with Togisti, a hereditary chief with the Wet'suwet'en Nation, and Freddie Hewson, a spokesperson for the Unist'ot'en clan, about a natural gas pipeline blockade that's been going over the winter, and they are now doing permaculture and pit houses in their fight against fracking. And finally, Emily Smith will chat about the Guatemalan court case against dictator Rios Montt, which was overturned this week. She'll talk about the context of that here on This Week on Media Mornings.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
And we'll be back with today's top news headlines. Our top story this week. In the United Kingdom, the murder of a soldier in South London on Wednesday has prompted fears of a backlash against British Muslims after the neo-fascist English Defence League staged an impromptu rally at the capital and two mosques were attacked. According to The Guardian, the neo-Nazi British National Party leader, Nick Griffin, has also reacted to the killing, with the provocative tweets calling for a protest in Woolwich and claiming the crime is the result of, quote, mass immigration. Farouk Murad of the Muslim Council of Britain said that the EDL's rally in London on Wednesday night was cause for concern. The Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, stressed that the murder of the soldier should not be viewed as religiously motivated crime. The blame, the mayor added, lay wholly and exclusively in the deluded mindset of the people who did it. Julie Siddiqui of the Islamic Society of Britain pointed out that the British Muslim community has been quick to condemn the atrocity and warned against letting the far right exploit the situation. Scores of supporters of the English Defence League threw bottles at police and chanted anti-Muslim slogans in Woolwich hours after the murder of the soldier on Wednesday afternoon. About 100 men, including some wearing balaclavas printed with EDL, engaged in running battles with police. Now in Victoria, BC, a large sign with the words Pkols carved into it was firmly cemented into the ground on Wednesday evening as First Nations people, accompanied by hundreds of supporters, proclaimed a return to the traditional name for a place that has been known as Mount Douglas. To the beat of drums, as an eagle drifted overhead, the Times columnist reports that the mixed Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal crowd cheered the name reclamation after carrying a sign to the summit of Pkols. As Tsawaut Hereditary Chief Eric Pelkey said, quote, I think people are hungry for the history of indigenous people in the area. That they ask why there is no reflection of the injustices that have happened here in the past. People streamed up the mountain, as many as 600 to 700, police estimated, carrying placards saying reclaim, rename, reoccupy. Saanich Police Constable Petra Dornblatt estimated the event drew between 600 and 700 people. The mountain, is sacred to the Saanich people because it reflects their nation's birthplace. While First Nations took direct action on Wednesday to restore the original name of the mountain, they have also made an official application to the province for a name change. Mount Douglas is only the beginning, they said. The next renaming and reclaiming steps are likely to affect Mount Newton and Sydney Spit in the city. Artist Charles Elliott, who carved the sign showing a thunderbird over the mountain, drew thunderous applause as he noted that this action is outside the jurisdiction of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. Now, Bobby Lee Worm, a 26-year-old Aboriginal woman who was held in solitary confinement for more than 3 years, spoke at a press conference this week about the detrimental effects of solitary confinement punishment in Canadian prisons. The TAI reports that in March 2011, Corrections Services of Canada opted to cancel the protocol that was used to keep Worm in solitary confinement, following a lawsuit Worm filed against the federal government to help with the help from the BC Civil Liberties Association. The lawsuit was recently settled. Although representatives were not allowed to release the details, BCCLA's litigation director stated that the solitary confinement is illegal, cruel, counterproductive, and should have no place in Canadian prisons. Worm was in prison since she was 19. Serving time for multiple offenses, including robbery, she was sentenced to 6 years and held in solitary confinement for more than 3.5 in total. She was confined to a cell that was 8 by 10 feet and deprived of meaningful human contact for up to 23 hours a day, for months at a time. Now, the deepening expenses scandal at the federal Senate has the Prime Minister in Latin America answering questions on his trip to trying to push for a trade alliance membership in that continent that many consider unnecessary. The Canadian Press reports that Harper's trade tour south comes in the wake of the resignation of his chief of staff, Nigel Wright, this week, who resigned Sunday as a result of his role in a ballooning controversy involving the disallowed expenses of Senator Mike Duffy. Wright wrote Duffy a personal check for $90,000 to cover the senator's improper housing claims, a quiet transaction critics say violates ethics rules prohibiting senators from accepting gifts. The embattled Senator Duffy quit the Conservative caucus last Thursday. Senator Pamela Wallin, who is facing her own expenses audit, recused herself from caucus on Friday. The expenses controversy is fast becoming one of the most serious challenges faced by the Harper administration. MPs have been hearing from upset constituents, with Ethics Commissioner investigating the matter and the NDP asking the RCMP to probe Wright's actions as well. Meanwhile, the Ottawa Citizen reports that a committee report on Senator Duffy's residence expenses was heavily edited or scrubbed, with references to the unambiguous and very clear Senate expense rules removed before it was released to the public this month. The document also scrubbed references to an attempt by Duffy's lawyer to wrap up what she called an unnecessary audit of his expenses. Now, in blood donation news, Canada is finally lifting a 30-year-old ban on gay men giving blood, though for the time being, only those who are abstinent will be allowed to donate. The Canadian Press reports that the new policy, which Canadian Blood Services hopes to have in place by midsummer, will allow men to give blood if they haven't had sex with another man for 5 years before the donation. The agency understands that the length of this deferral won't satisfy all critics, but agency executive said that this was the first step in what Canada Blood Services hopes will be continued effort to work out what is the best approach to incorporating gay men into the donation community. The Canadian AIDS Society, which was working with Health Canada and two blood agencies, welcomed the move, but the federal New Democrats echoed their position and said that the five-year deferral still discriminates against gay men. The system would be safer if it simply focused on screening out high-risk donors, whatever their sexual education, the party said. Now in Toronto news, the Catholic School Board has banned Mayor Rob Ford from coaching football at any Catholic school in the city, ending a decade-long affiliation with Don Bosco School that has brought Ford personal joy along with political praise and criticism. The decision does not appear to be related to the growing crack cocaine scandal that Ford is now facing, which centers on a video in which Ford appears to be smoking crack cocaine, referring to Don Bosco players as just effing minorities, and calling Justin Trudeau, quote, a fag. Director of Education for the school board has in fact been reviewing Ford's role at Don Bosco since March, after he said on a Sun News interview, incorrect according to the school board's statements, that the children would not be attending school if not for the football program, came from gangs and broken homes. Ford's role as a coach is a central component of his political persona. Meanwhile, Rob Ford alternately ignored and mocked television reporters, but said nothing new about the controversy. However, his brother, Councillor Doug Ford, delivered a speech on Wednesday in which he did not directly deny the allegations facing his brother, lambasted the assembled media, and talked at length about unrelated issues. No questions were allowed. Experts in damage control were aghast at the handling of the six-day-old crack cocaine crisis that shows no signs of waning. And meanwhile, an online fundraising drive to purchase the video has so far reached $130,000 out of the needed $200,000. Now, south of the border, the United States has killed four of its own citizens in drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan. The Barack Obama administration has finally acknowledged. Al Jazeera reports that Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, said in a letter addressed to congressional leaders that three of those killed were not targets of the strikes involving drones. Holder named the four dead U.S. citizens in a letter to members of Congress one day before President Obama delivered an address on the issue of drones on Thursday. Amnesty International pointed out in its new report that the U.S. policy appears to permit extrajudicial executions of American citizens in violation of international law. However, in response to criticism, the White House announced a series of measures aimed at moving the controversial U.S. automated drone killings program out of the, quote, legal shadows on Thursday. In a major counterterrorism speech billed as marking the end of an unfettered war on terror, Barack Obama has revealed that he will move responsibility for future drone operations from the CIA to the Pentagon so they could be more closely monitored by Congress. Now, in Sweden, hundreds of youth burnt down a restaurant, set fire to more than 30 cars, and attacked police during a fourth night of rioting in the suburbs of Stockholm, seemingly sparked by police killing a man, shocking a country that has dodged the worst of the financial crisis but failed to solve youth unemployment and resentment among asylum seekers. Violence spread across the Swedish capital on Wednesday as large numbers of young people rampaged through the suburbs, throwing stones, breaking windows, and destroying cars. Police in the southern city of Malmo said two cars had been set ablaze. Media reports said a police station was set on fire in Stockholm's southern suburb, where several people were also detained, but no one was hurt. The disappearances appear to have been sparked by the police killing of a 69-year-old man wielding machete in the suburb of Husby earlier this month, which prompted accusations of police brutality. The riots have spread throughout the poor Stockholm suburbs. In Russia, an imprisoned member of the Russian punk band Pussy Riot has announced a hunger strike after being refused the right to attend her own parole hearing. BBC News reports that imprisoned band member Maria Alyukhina said used video link from her prison to tell the court in Ural's town of Berezniki that her legal rights have been violated. Last month, fellow band member Nadezhda Tolokoneva was denied parole. The two women were jailed for 2 years in August, including hard labor camp, for a breach of public order motivated by religious hatred. They had performed an obscenity-laced punk prayer at Moscow's main cathedral in protest against Vladimir Putin during his re-election campaign. An appeals court suspended the sentence of a third band member, Yekaterina Samosevich, in October, but upheld the jail terms for Tolokonikova and Alyukhina. The prosecution of band members last drew condemnation from human rights and civil liberties groups worldwide. And finally, Amnesty International has said in its annual report on global human rights that the rights of millions of refugees and migrants have been abused severely in the past year. Al Jazeera reports that the London-based rights group said that state authorities and employers were equally responsible for the suffering of vulnerable groups. The report said the world has failed the Syrian people, caught up in a spiraling conflict which has seen 4.5 million people displaced from their homes inside the country and 1.5 million living in refugee camps in neighboring countries. Amnesty also singled out governments for failing to protect the rights of migrant domestic workers. And Amnesty also accused Europe of putting the lives of migrants and asylum seekers at risk with border control operations, warning that foreign workers face increased hostility there because of job shortages. And that is our news headlines for this week on Media Mornings. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. You can also find us on Rabble Podcasting Network. rabble.ca. Now, for our next interview, we're going to be featuring our correspondent in Pakistan, Jahanzeb Hossain. He's a regular contributor to our program and is there in the wake of the presidential elections. This is interview with Derek O'Keefe on our program last Friday.
The chief election commissioner has the air of a man whose job was well done. It's the largest ever exercise in Pakistani democracy. More than 50 million people casting their votes.
The percentage of voting is very high. This is what I call empowerment of the people, a public show of strength.
Nawaz Sharif will be Pakistan's first three-time prime minister, hoping no doubt that after being driven from office by the army on two previous occasions, this time he'll get to complete his five-year term. It was a satisfying victory for Sharif's Muslim League over the Pakistan People's Party, which for decades has been the only other viable horse in the race for national political power. But emerging in this election, a third force in Pakistani politics, Imran Khan's Movement for Justice, or PTI, may only have come second in the polls, but it was a staggering first innings.
And that was a short report from Al Jazeera News on the aftermath of the Pakistan elections. And we're very happy to have on the phone Jahanzeb Hossain. Good morning, Jahanzeb, or good evening to you.
Good evening and good morning to you. It's 7 o'clock in the evening for me now. First time on Media Mornings at this time and not early in the morning.
Well, we're really happy to have you on the air, and a little bit easier to do radio at 7 in the evening, I imagine, but not that easy.
Yeah,
because
it is.
You're phoning in today from Karachi, is that correct?
I am. I'm calling from my home.
Perfect. And Jahanzeb, tell us about the day that you flew, and it takes a full day, basically, and with the time change, you actually miss a whole day. While you were in the air, the elections were actually taking place. Tell us what you arrived to, I guess, just over a week ago now.
Yeah, I got there Sunday morning, so it was morning after the elections, and I was expecting the city to be shut down and there to be violence or unrest, but there was actually nothing. I mean, my house is normally half an hour or 45 minutes away from the airport, but in the morning the road was clear and I got home in like 15 minutes, which was quite unusual. But there was nothing in the city. Like, before that there was some violence, but right after the elections and during the day there was nothing, no unrest, no violence whatsoever, and that was a pleasant surprise for once.
Well, that's certainly good to hear. And this is, my understanding, the first time in Pakistani history that a civilian government has handed over power to another civilian government, as in it hasn't been interrupted by the military taking power. Is that correct?
That is true. First time in Pakistani history since 1947. First time a civilian government finished its five-year term and handed over power to another civilian government through democratic process. First time. So it's quite an achievement, even though there has to be some reservations about it, because the previous government of Asif Ali Zardari, his party, Pakistan People's Party, was an incredibly corrupt and corrupt party and government. But at the same time, it is something that this kind of transition is in place.
We'll speak a little bit about the case and the charges against former president and military dictator Musharraf, and related to the murder of Benazir Bhutto. But first I wanted to ask you about Nawaz Sharif and this election campaign. Was his party or any party really making a sort of populist appeal to the poor and popular classes of Pakistan? We often only hear about this country in terms of the war on terror and foreign policy matters here, but there's a huge problem of inequality and poverty in Pakistan. So which party was really appealing to the poor, and how did they pitch those appeals, or were class issues not really a factor here?
You're right, the class issues were not a factor. Land reform, Pakistan is mostly a feudal country, but land reforms are not on the agenda of any party. There's no party which wants to carry out land reforms, and the reason is that because they themselves drive power from this basic feudal structure. So be it PPP, which has power, which is a party of feudal lords itself in Sindh, or in Punjab, where Nawaz Sharif, even though he's an industrialist himself, but he does have a base in the feudal, in the rural parts of the country, in the feudal parts of the country. So there was no appeal, a class-based appeal, towards the poor. In Pakistan, it has only happened once. That was under Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who managed to mobilize the poor on a kind of socialist agenda. But Nawaz Sharif did not do that. The only thing he was able to he said to poor people was like, well, I'm going to bring development to your villages, and I have a track record. I have built roads. I have bought some electricity. And if you vote for me again, then this would continue. But he did not talk about changing the basic structure of the feudal economy of Pakistan, and no other party did that because nobody wants to hit themselves with an axe. Nobody wants to shoot themselves in their own foot.
And the Bhutto government you're referring to is, of course, going back to the late 60s and through the 1970s, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And Bhutto the father was himself killed. I should probably now move to the Musharraf case. I also want to ask you about Imran Khan, whose party finished second in the elections. But on this Musharraf case, the fact that he's actually facing charges for things he did while in power, is this sort of another sign, along with the peaceful transfer of government, that the military's dominance in Pakistan is backing up, is rolling back a little bit? Or is this a sign that people within the military itself have lost confidence in Musharraf and are allowing this trial to proceed?
I think Musharraf does not really serve army's purpose anymore. I mean, he did when he was in power. And if Musharraf becomes too much of a problem for the army, then they will let go of him as well. And Nawaz Sharif, I don't think he's a vengeful person. I think he has learned his lessons from the previous two occasions that he was in power. I mean, he could easily let Musharraf go and move out of the country and go to his retirement house in Saudi Arabia, as all the other Muslim dictators do. That could possibly happen. And I think there is might be a feeling in the army itself that maybe the country needs some sort of stability. And I mean, Nawaz Sharif is a Punjab-based leader. And army's hold is also in Punjab. Its power base is in Punjab. So there are two in the civilian sphere. There's a Punjab-based party, and army is already there. So I mean, it's good for the province of Punjab to have that kind of dominance again, civilian sphere and also in the military sphere. So I think it is possible that the army and Nawaz Sharif could possibly work together where the interests meet.
That's very interesting. And as mentioned, Imran Khan's a part of the former cricketer who has now become a politician. His party finished second. He had a bad accident and actually broke his neck, I believe, or fractured his neck. Was seriously injured, but he survived and is on the mend. What was the base of his party's appeal? I know that he's been very outspoken against the U.S. drone attacks. That's sort of the main thing we've heard about him in the Western media. But what's behind his appeal in Pakistan? And they often say he has a big following amongst the youth. Do you find that this is true?
Well, no. Imran Khan, at the beginning, it seemed that he finished second, but actually he's not finishing third. The PPP is ahead of Imran Khan now by 4 seats, I believe. So Imran Khan's main appeal was among urban youth educated, well, so-called educated, I mean, youth who've been to formal English education, have gone and studied abroad and so on and so forth. Those were his main constituency, but the thing about that is that there are not enough that type of people in Pakistan who could turn the race into his favor. I mean, he was depending solely on the youth, which is one factor among many other factors. So his blind spot was that he did not address all the other factors and depended too much on youth. And the other thing was that his other agenda was anti-Americanism, which is a bit of a delusion because Pakistanis, American drone strikes is one of their concerns, but the other concerns too, which are more important for Pakistanis, such as reviving the economy and basic rights as a citizen, and those are the bigger issues for Pakistanis than drone attacks. So he can speak against drone attacks. There's a populist appeal to that, but when people go to vote, people in the rest of the country, because the drone attacks only happen in Waziristan, where people have difficulty voting anyway. So when people in Karachi or Lahore or rural Sindh and Punjab, they go and vote, they don't have any danger from American drones. So why should they vote for Imran Khan? And also, you're talking about the youth. The youth is not only in the educated or rich parts of Karachi and Lahore. There's a youth in interior Sindh. How can Imran Khan mobilize them when he does not talk about land reforms?
And that was Jahan Sabah Hussain live from Karachi, Pakistan, interviewed by Derek O'Keefe on our Friday program. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca, and now podcasting on Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Our next interview is with Megan Rode of Human Rights Watch in New York City, and Bridget Tolley, co-founder of Families of Sisters in Spirit in Ottawa. They're addressing an RCMP report investigation into the Human Rights Watch report that alleges massive violations against Aboriginal women in British Columbia, including gang rape, beatings, dog attacks, and more. Here they are, interviewed by Anushka Nagji and I on our program last Monday. On the phone, we're very excited to have Megan Rode from Human Rights Watch. She's the author of a report they put out earlier this year that led to this week an announcement by the RCMP that they would be investigating severe allegations of abuse, including gang rapes and beatings in BC. Also on the phone is Bridget Tolley. She's the co-founder of Families of Sisters in Spirit. She's in Ottawa. Good morning.
Good morning.
So maybe we could just start off with Megan. Could you talk a little bit about the RCMP's announcement and how you've received it?
Right. So when our report was released in February, the government referred the report over to the Commission for Public Complaints against the RCMP for investigation. And we were very encouraged to see that the report was being taken seriously. And with this last week's announcement that they have developed terms of reference, we felt that it was, you know, necessary to take a hard look at what exactly an investigation by the Commission for Public Complaints would be able to achieve. And we do have some concerns about such an investigation, in particular that the Commission is perhaps not at an adequate distance from the RCMP itself to be able to conduct a fully independent investigation that would really garner the trust of the community in such a way as to be able to get at these very difficult, serious, and sometimes hidden issues of abuse.
Maybe jumping over to Bridget, could you talk about your reaction to the RCMP's investigation, as well as maybe in the aftermath of the report's release, if you've seen any progress?
Hi, everyone.
Good morning.
You know, it's been really hard. You know, even before and after the report, the abuse is still there. So as far as I see it, there's no change. It's always police investigating police, which is one of the biggest problems. Even in my mother's case, my mother was struck and killed by the Quebec police here, and it was the brother of the cop that struck and killed my mom that was in charge of the scene. And I've been trying to get an independent investigation for about 11 years now. So it's always the same thing. It's police investigating police. So how are we going to move forward? And the police are one of the biggest problems all across Canada.
So maybe a question for both of you. What would then be a satisfactory result from the release of this report? So we know that maybe it is somewhat problematic that the RCMP is basically investigating itself, but what would be an appropriate result? Megan, if you want to go first.
Sure. Well, one of the things that we had hoped would happen would be that the BC government would take the step to allow the Independent Investigations Office in the province to investigate at least some of the allegations made in the report, because that body is independent of the police. It's civilian-led, and we believe, you know, could provide an effective investigation. But the difficulty is that their mandate is quite limited, including it is limited such that it would exclude crimes of sexual assault by police officers. So we feel that that's something that has to be fixed by the government, but also that as an ad hoc step, they could have referred the report over to the IIO for investigation, and that perhaps would have been a better result than the Commission for Public Complaints undertaking the investigation.
Bridget, did you have any comment?
Well, for me, it's got to be the people ourselves, you know, that's been doing all this work. You know, it hasn't been work, and everybody's, you know, like the RCMP to investigate, it's not working. It's got to be different people, and not even leaders or MPs or anybody like that. Even, you know, if they get civilian people, they usually get ex-police officers or retired police officers to come and do this. So I think it's got to be a bunch of people together that have nothing to do with the police.
Maybe, Megan, could you just go over for our listeners what was in the report that was so shocking? I mean, the police reacted very swiftly, and at first there was a very defensiveness to it. I think that continued, but they were demanding that the victims' names be revealed, and that because they said they couldn't investigate until they knew who was making the allegations. People said they were too scared to come forward. Could you say what it was they were scared of, and what kind of things you alleged?
Right. So the report looked at two parts of the policing problem in northern BC. It looked at, on the one hand, complaints from women and from families about how the police responded to violence in the community. So issues of domestic violence going inadequately addressed, missing persons complaints, including some associated with the Highway of Tears, that they felt were not adequately investigated. And then on the other side, it looked at allegations that police officers themselves have been responsible for abusive acts, from excessive use of force in arresting people, in particular in association with arrests for public intoxication, all the way up to physical and sexual assault. And as you note, the government did call for the names of the victims to be brought forward, and we had guaranteed to the victims that we would not be publishing their names. We used pseudonyms in the report, and we feel strongly that it's incumbent on the government to ensure that there's a independent, trustworthy complaint system that can make victims feel comfortable coming forward, that it's not actually, that the onus should not be placed on the victims themselves, that rather the government needs to be responsible for preventing and responding to this kind of violence.
So now, Bridget, you had brought up a really good point referring to sort of the community response, or there needs to be a response that isn't related to government or MLAs or politicians, but that is completely separate. Could maybe either of you talk about what that looks like? Bridget, you wanted to respond?
Well, you know, we've seen everybody, there's been so many studies and reports and everything, you know, and I think the people, even recommendations, you know, there's been recommendations from the Amnesty, Stolen Sisters, 2004, you know, people have been making so many recommendations on how we can get this going or how it can be brought forward, but none of nobody's listening to these recommendations. And even them, just a few days ago, there was a thing in the paper saying Harper skeptical of inquiry to missing and murdered women. And there he goes on saying, he said that the issue has been studied extensively and that it's time to pass it to action. But yet he puts this special committee on that has no agenda. I don't even know their agenda. They don't even know their agenda. And they have an ear, so that should be, the special committee should be done, I think, in March of next year, the end of March, and we're already May. So nothing's been happening. I mean,
so they haven't spoken to you or asked you to testify as one of the founders of the main missing women's advocacy group in Canada?
No, the families are not involved again, and they're listening again to all these ministers, like the Minister of Justice and all them, and National Aboriginal Organizations, but they're not listening to the families. And this is one of the biggest problems that we're having, you know, because nobody's listening to us. And even that special committee, they don't even know where they're going or where their budget is or if they're allowed to travel yet. So now we're at, what, we're in the middle of May. We have another 4 weeks of this committee. Then they're going to be off for about 3 months for the summer because they're not going to be sitting while Parliament's not there. So when they come back, it's going to be half over. Then they do another 2-3 months, and they're off for holidays again in December. So we can tell that this committee already is not going to be doing too much. We need time for action. We need action. We need even a public inquiry. It's going to take too long. You know, we're going to wait years. Not only that, there has been some, you know, they had the National Aboriginal Summit last November in Winnipeg, and they said, they talked about missing and murdered women, and now they said, okay, well, nothing came out of that meeting, so now we're going to have a meeting in 2014 in New Brunswick. So what are families supposed to do? Are we supposed to wait till they have this meeting and then figure out what we're going to do? No, families keep going. And, you know, police are the biggest problem all across Canada. And how can we go to the people that are abusing us? How do we go ask them for help? How do we ask them for protection? You know, people don't want to do that. Even in my mother's case, there's three police forces involved. There's the Sûreté de Québec, there's the Native police, and then we had the Montreal police force. So it's all police investigating police.
And that was Bridget Tolley, founder of Families of Sisters in Spirit, as well as Megan Rode, the women's rights researcher with Human Rights Watch based in New York City. They were interviewed by Anushka Nagji and I on the program on Monday. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFR 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca, and now podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca. Our next interview is going to be with two land defenders in northern BC. Tohisti is a hereditary chief with Laksamashuk clan of the Wet'suwet'en, and Frida Hewson is a spokesperson for the Unist'ot'en. They've been maintaining an action camp on the site of the Pacific Trails Pipeline in northern BC. Natural gas pipeline that will take gas from fracking to the coast. They're now digging pit houses and doing permaculture on the way of the line, saying that they're decolonizing the land and preventing the pipeline from being built. Here they are interviewed by Anushka Nagji and I last Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
We're doing good. A little bit tired, but we're doing good.
Now, we spoke to you, I think, just after you started the blockade, the full-time blockade up there. When was that exactly?
The full-time blockade started on November 20th.
So you've been going all winter. Could you talk about maybe just how things have gone? And you've talked about setting up some permaculture stuff right now there on the site of the pipeline path.
Yeah, well, we have a permaculture garden, and we also have a pit house construction project happening right now. And since the blockade time, we've had very little activity on the road coming into the camp, but a lot of air activity. We had a lot of helicopters flying over our camp almost on a bi-daily basis, as well as airplanes and stuff. And basically just harassing flights, flying low right over the cabin, doing circles and, you know, hovering down so they can try and get a better look inside and stuff like that. It was kind of annoying, but, you know, it was nothing more than just harassment.
Could you talk about why you set up the blockade and how the company has responded? Like, what is that issue here?
The company hasn't really responded to anything that we've said. We basically let them know that in 2006 our people 100% said no to the Pacific Trails Pipeline, and we accused them of attempting to avoid consultation in their legal processes, avoid consultation with the hereditary owners, and instead decided to skirt around hereditary chiefs and try and talk to just individual bands and tribal councils. And, you know, they keep telling people in their press releases that they have 15 out of 16 First Nation people support, and those are Indian bands, but you only have jurisdiction on their Indian reservations.
No, this is a pipe. Go on.
Go ahead.
Oh, this is a pipeline that is transporting liquefied natural gas that's taken from fracking to the coast. Obviously, a very big electric.
Is that right? I'll just do one really quick correction. It's not liquefied natural gas. It's liquefied fractured gas.
So it's from hydraulic fracturing.
Liquefied fracking gas is liquefied fracking gas is a lot different from natural gas.
What are your main concerns with it?
Well, the fracking process introduces toxins to an ecosystem where they actually do the fracking. And this is up in the Horn River Basin up in northeastern British Columbia. And it's up around Fort Nelson and right down into Fort St. John. It's a huge shale deposit that they've discovered has natural gas, so fractured gas, I mean. So what they do is they inject chemicals into the earth and create small explosions, and these chemicals seep into, with a huge amount of water, seep into the shale formations and release gas, but those chemicals also leach into aquifers. And it's been proven over and over and over again. It doesn't matter what kind of measures they try and put in place. It's been proven over and over again that these toxins leak into the aquifers as well as the methane, and it's quite dangerous. And what they're attempting to do is to pollute the Arctic Ocean, because all the waters that flow out of the Liard River flow up into the Arctic Ocean, and it compounds what's happening with the tar sands. So the Pacific Trails Pipeline project is proposed to basically blaze the way for another huge pipeline that is it's quite very much in the public eye right now. It's the Enbridge pipeline, which is attempting to take tar sands fuel out of the tar sands in northern Alberta and truck it on the exact same route as Pacific Trails to the coast. And our people have said no to both of those pipelines, as well as all fracking gas pipelines, such as the Coastal Gassing Pipeline and many others that are being proposed, and they're just attempting to bulldoze their way through.
So if we wanted to now maybe pass it over to Frida. So Frida, we were going to ask about last year's Action Camp. There was an invitation for activists who went up, I think it was in July or August of last year. And is there a similar Action Camp happening this year and fundraising happening for that as well?
Yes, we have an annual camp every year, ever since the pipelines had proposed 4 years ago, since we found out about it. So we've been having camps every year to bring in supporters. So we are having another one this year, second week in July.
And are you doing fundraising or asking for supplies or anything for the camp?
Yep, we've been doing that ongoing. So we mostly go for grassroots supporters because we don't go after any government funding or anything like that.
And
industry funds.
If we wanted to go and find out where to donate or what's going on with the camp, where would we go?
Lunas.dencamp.com.
Excellent. So what are the plans then for this summer?
This summer we'll be doing a one-week camp, and I believe we have media training, like how to do videos, how to do editing, and decolonization workshops, because a lot of people are so colonized that they're not really aware of what it is we're doing here. Like when people actually come here, they, even though they're all understanding of why we're opposing the pipelines, when they're not really decolonized, they don't really get the big picture. And when they come here, they said there's a total change in their life, that they're even giving more of themselves on how to block the pipelines and all these destructive industries that are impacting our environment.
Could you talk a bit more? Could you talk more about what is decolonization to you? Like, what does that mean, and what does that look like for society?
Well, when you're out here, you're getting back to the land, and you're getting back to the basics. And right now, everybody's like into electronics and into working these 9-to-5 jobs and into making money and into buying more toys, and they're all into this economic wheel that it absorbs them so much that it takes over their whole lives, and they become like zombies, and that's all they do every day. And when we leave here and go into the cities, that's what we see. It's just like we enter zombie land. Everybody's just like machines, and they're just going, and they're going by the clock, and they lose themselves in that system, and they lose their spirit. It's just like they're walking around dead.
Maybe
when you come back here, you get life.
Maybe one last question. That was Frida Husson, spokesperson for the Unistaten clan, as well as Togristi, a hereditary chief with the Laksamishu clan, of both from Wet'suwet'en Nation and blockading the Pacific Trails pipeline. Well, our final song today is going to be Electronic Intertribal off of Tribe Called Red's brand new album, Nation to Nation. And our final interview will be talking about the celebrated human rights verdict against former dictator in Guatemala, Rios Montt, which unfortunately was overturned this week. Here's Electric Intertribal. That is Electric Intertribal from A Tribe Called Red's brand new album, Nation to Nation, just out last week. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here in Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. We're also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network, rabble.ca. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Our final interview is going to be with Emily Smith, speaking about the former dictator's trial in Guatemala. She spoke with Jane Bowie on Wednesday. Here's their interview.
The former president of Guatemala, General Rios Montt, was found guilty May 10th of overseeing the deliberate killings by the armed forces of at least 1,771 members of the Maya population during his 1982-83 rule. He was sentenced to 80 years in prison, marking a breakthrough in the redress of wrongdoings by past governments in the hemisphere. The conviction was met with jubilation, but has been now annulled by Guatemala's constitutional court. The annulment has dismayed, to put it mildly, people in Guatemala, in particular the Mayan who had celebrated the conviction of the former dictator. On the line we have Emily Smith, Anglican priest, who has spent much of her life working with the peasants and Maya of Guatemala. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
I understand it's a bit early for you.
I don't know where I am still.
Anyway, can you give the listeners a sense of what the conviction meant to ordinarily Guatemalans, especially the Maya?
Right. Well, as you said, he's one man who was involved in a huge operation that was not just him, but he was kind of a symbolic figure as well as, of course, the real figure. He took office in a coup in March of 1982 and was in office until he was ousted in another coup in August of 83. Now, he was being... the trial was focused on one of the Mayan... There's 22 different Mayan nations in Guatemala, so he was particularly... It was focused on one of those Mayan nations, and there was, as you said, 1,800 or so registered, identified people who died within that community within his time period. But the whole genocide was much larger, and his participation and his the death toll under him was much higher. So there was indeed, during the 36-year war, about they estimate about 200,000 people were killed in the genocide, and about 45,000 were disappeared as well.
And I understand that in specifically in the years that he was in power, that short period of time, that the United Nations Truth Commission detailed the annihilation of almost 600 villages, including massacres in specific places.
Exactly. So there's really no doubt that he is guilty, that he was guilty. It's just that in Guatemala there's been no justice for... there's been very, very few cases. Only a few cases have ever gone to trial, and never anything on this magnitude. So for about 10 years, and then there was a complication in that he, after he was ousted in the second coup, then he later became a member of the Congress. He was, he was like a congressman for 12 years, and he couldn't be prosecuted while he was in government. That's sort of one of the rules under the immunity law. Sorry, so he didn't get, he wasn't able to be, no one was able to prosecute him. But there was a process, an international process, actually sort of anchored in Spain, and there was, he had been, there was an arrest warrant out for him. He couldn't leave the country, first of all, because he knew that the second he left the country, he would be nabbed and carried off to an international court where he would be tried. So the most amazing thing about this was that it actually happened in Guatemala, where nobody goes to jail. Like, you want to murder somebody and get away with it, go do it in Guatemala, because the impunity rate is so high, and the murder rate is so high.
There was
the fact that it happened in Guatemala was just astonishing. None of us could believe it.
And
the whole process started when he ended his term in office, and of course he's an old man now, and the Ministerio Público, which is, I guess it's the public prosecutor's office, started this mechanism to bring him to justice. Him, and then there was a second fellow, Mauricio Rodriguez Sanchez, who was his defense minister at the same time. So the two of them were on trial together. And this whole trial, so he was then put under house arrest, and that went on for about a year, and then in it sort of like slowly started to kick in, and the most amazing twists and turns were offered by his defense lawyers, but nonetheless the trial began officially in March, was when the when the actual trial this day started. And so we just, and it was the most heart-wrenching. I've been doing Guatemala work for almost 30 years, and we've all known about him forever, and we've all, you know, he's been a figure for all of the pain of everybody. You know, of course he's not responsible for all of it, but certainly the sense of this man, and just having to sit there, he had to sit there, and all of the witnesses that came, the most courageous people on earth, came and gave their testimony, and it was numerous women who had been subject to horrendous campaigns of rape, which was never really brought up in trials before, but the use of rape as in the genocide was a huge part of the genocide trial, and other witnesses. So it was kind of a, it was a balance between these courageous, amazing men and women from the Ischia region who had been survivors and witnesses and victims, and then experts. So on the other side, there was all of these amazing testimonies of experts of every different imaginable kind. So there were forensic anthropologists and statisticians, and just every kind of imaginable expert on racism, just analyzing the greatest work ever I've ever seen, analyzing what is genocide.
And that was Emily Smith, Anglican priest, longtime worker in Central America, interviewed by Jane Bowie on Wednesday's program of Media Mornings. Well, that's our show for this week. You are listening to This Week on Media Mornings here in Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca/thisweek. You can also find us on Rabble's podcast network at rabble.ca. I'm David Ball. Thanks for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news, from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are, I've continued to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.